This program is brought to you by Stanford on iTunes U at Stanford University. Please visit us at itunes.stanford.edu.
Professor Evans is sitting back there looking very pleased with himself. I have no idea why. Little does Professor Evans know, as he sits there looking so smug, that a dreadful whirlwind of excitement is coming his way in about 10 or 15 minutes. I can assure you he won't know how to handle it. We'll begin off this morning with the final imponderable, great, universal, cosmic question. Now, don't start to cry immediately. I know your hearts are breaking with that announcement, but there is this one final question, and all of you will vote as usual on this. This is an entirely different sort of question. This is a totally literary question. I think I'll just wait for that lovely daily to be put aside. I think I, yes, thank you, my friend. Thank you, my friend. This is a totally literary question, and it goes as follows. And you will see the applicability of it immediately. Do you believe, including my friend right there, and he is my friend, right there. Yeah, no, I wasn't pointing you out. Do you believe that in a work of literature, do you believe that in a work of literature, a character can get out of the control of an author? In your literary instincts, does that happen in creative works of literature? An author loses control of a character, or can sometimes lose control of a character, or is it part of the definition of authorial intent, of authorial control, that a character, by definition, could never escape the control of its author? All right. Any clarification? We will do the regular. So the first vote will be for those who believe that, yes, such a thing does happen between an author and a character, at least at times. So all those who are going to vote yes to that great question, so indicate. And Erin, and Liz, you get up. Oh, Professor Evans is going berserk at this point. Look, he's turned ashen. Look at this. He's laughing, but he is flashing daggers at all these hands up. All right. And now everyone else, including, I presume, Professor Evans' own strong right arm, will shoot up that this does not, cannot happen in a work of fiction. All right, so that looks to me about 80-20, something. 75-25? 85-15? 60-40. 60-40? Holy smokes. All right, we'll call it 65-35 in favor of narrative control on occasion being lost. Thank you. Thank you, my friends. And in about 5 minutes or so, when we turn from this magnificent overhead to the next one, of course, as you know, it'll be right there as one of the huge central questions for book four, for the central Dido and Aeneas book. But let's start off for just a few minutes on book three. So Aeneas has finished the first of his two books, of the recounting of his travails, his suffering at Troy, and his wanderings from Troy literally to the palace at Carthage. He has done that in book two, and now in book three he tells the rest of his story to the smitten Queen Dido. I want all of us to fasten on the following deep theme in book three, namely the theme of the search for a new home. It seems to me that along with all kinds of other things that happen in book three, the recurring question, the recurring false leads, the recurring partially understood prophecies, and so on, are all revolving around the same set of issues and the same questions. Where are we going? Where will our new home be? How will we ever find out what the proper direction for us to pursue toward our new home will be? Now, as in so much, in fact, as in virtually everything in the Aeneid, as you already know full well, there is a Homeric antecedent for this and a Homeric rival that Virgil constantly plays off of. And that is the travel books that Odysseus recounts to the Phaeacians in the court of the Phaeacians that last over four books of the Odyssey. Now there, Odysseus is talking in terms of his years of wandering of how he is searching and searching and is still searching for the way to get home to his old home. What Odysseus wants to do is return home. What Aeneas, in a much more horrible situation, it seems to me, what Aeneas is searching for is some sense of clarity on how to leave behind everything that was his and to identify and get to what will be his new home. Along the way here, just about in the middle of the book, is another of the great series of prophetic utterances in the epic. This one, the prophecy coming from the seer Helenus. Just look for a moment on page 79. At the beginning of the prophecy, at verses 5:10 and following. So Helenus, with oracular voice, addressed me, born of the goddess, highest auspices are clearly to be seen for your seafaring. The Lord God deals out destiny so, and turns the wheel of change, so turns the world. And I've just written up here so they're right in front of us. We don't have to flip back to another of the handout pages. Are absolutely key terms here. Fatum and the plural fata for fate, destiny, and it's the word used right here for destiny. And then in various places that I'll point to, pietas and pius. So this is destined. This is fated. If only Aeneas will realize and catch on to exactly what that means. That's the issue again and again. And at the end of Helenus' prophecy, on page 81, at 590 and following, further clarity comes. And this happens in bits and pieces throughout book three and succeeding books. You will be sent to Italy. Ashore there, when you reach the town of Cumae, Avernus's murmuring forests, haunted lakes, you'll see a spellbound prophetess who sings in her deep cave of destinies, Fata, confiding symbols and words to leave. So this, of course, is not only a prophecy in and of itself, it's a prediction of the next great prophetic encounter with the Sibyl in Book 6. So as Aeneas comes to this point in Book 3, remember he's sitting there holding Dido the hapless, smitten Dido just in the palm of his hand with this gripping narrative. As that scene is taking place during Book 2 and now in Book 3, Dido is listening and clearly not taking in that Aeneas is announcing, Italy is my destiny. Italy is my fate. And it must recur a half dozen times with increasing force throughout Book 3 as Dido is sitting there listening to her new heroic would-be lover, at least in her eyes. And then, of course, a little further in Book 3, Aeneas and his fellow Trojans actually catch their first sight of Italy. And he recounts that. And at the end of Book 3 is one of the most remarkable vignettes, sad vignettes, namely the death of Anchises. Let's look at that for a moment on page 91. And the particular reason I want us to look at this, right down at the bottom of page 90 and the top of page 91. And in the end, the port of Drepanum, which is right on that magnificent map that you have, right on the northwest shore of Sicily. In one of the wonderful seminars that I've been going to this week, one of your fellow students in a great presentation had a multicolored, beautiful map of the wanderings of Aeneas and held it up and clearly was mocking my map. I mean, it was mano a mano, and there it was, and she was saying, well, maybe she, maybe he, but it's a she. Who but a woman would have the strength of purpose to do this, and saying, well, at least on this map, as opposed to Professor McCall's map, at least you can see the names and so on. She didn't actually say that, but I know it was in her mind. I know it was in her mind. In any case, so they get to the port of Drepanum, took me in, a landing without joy, for after storms at sea had buffeted me so often, here, alas, I lost my father. Solace in all affliction and mischance, O best of fathers in my weariness, though you had been delivered from so many perils in vain, alas, here you forsook me. Now look what Virgil says next. Never had Helenus the seer, who warned of many things to make me quail, foretold this grief to me, nor had the vile Calino. Here was my final sorrow. Now just take this in as blow upon blow to the would-be Stoic hero Aeneas. Aeneas is intended, he is supposed to be accepting his Stoic Roman imperial destiny. And we saw Virgil give to him in that verb in the last line of Book 2, I gave in, I resigned myself to follow my fate, Kessi. That was literally Virgil giving to his hero, to our hero Aeneas, a Stoic term for accepting, for taking on his fate. But what if, as a Stoic hero, or someone attempting to be a Stoic hero, what if you don't have a clue about the fate that you're supposed to take on? Then you really are in terrible travails, and this is the sadness that Virgil seems to be giving to Aeneas to express here. It wasn't as if I, Aeneas, had been told Soon you will lose your father, Anchises, and you will have to learn how to take that on, as well as the loss of your wife and so on. This comes as a complete surprise. So sadness upon sadness upon sadness. And at the end of book three, Virgil has these two books of Aeneas's story come to an end. He fell silent at last and made an end. And then look immediately at the start of book four. The queen, for her part, all that evening ached with longing that her heart's blood fed, a wound of inward fire eating her away. So while Virgil is having Aeneas struggle to be a perfect Stoic national founding hero, Virgil is having Dido, the queen of Carthage, come apart inside in a way that is antithetical, totally antithetical to Stoic virtues. Irrational passion, the irrational passion that the gods bestowed on her through the machinations of Cupid, through the lap sitting. Think how would we stage this scene at Duke University? Oh, isn't that terrible? Isn't that terrible? Anyway, Cupid's lap sitting. Of course, it's reverse gender roles, but that's all right. That's all right. At the end of book three, takes Queen Dido, the proud queen of a growing city, and tosses her into the maelstrom of irrational, unstoic passion that consumes her. And this is reflected in the opening verses, the very opening verses of book four. All right, now I'm just going to make a switch here. As I just make the switch on the glorious overhead, is Esosa here. Esosa, would you please come down here and join me? My friends, you are about to have the delight of something that, well, of course, I'm absolutely terrified here because I know very well that in years to come, when you talk to your grandchildren about, well, what happened in your fall term IHUM, it's not going to be Professor McCall's mellifluous words. It's not even going to be Professor Evans' great statements. It's going to be what you're going to witness now in the next couple of minutes. Here we are at the beginning of book four. We're going to spend most of the rest of the class on it, but we're going to be introduced to it by Esosa. Okay.
Basically, what happened was we came to the right section, and we did the facilitation, and when we did it, it was a wrap. And so he was like, I would love to do a wrap about that. And so I got it. Well, here, give it to us. Don't worry. It sounds really good. If I close my eyes, but I don't want to see you guys watching it. So my love and his will never ever meant to be. How bittersweet love could ever be. My love and his will. My tragic story for the whole world to see. My love and his will. Man, let it rain, man. I got some pain, you see. My love and his will never ever meant to be. How bittersweet love could ever be. Back in the day when love was more than just play. Got up felt the prick of Cupid calling her name. And from a night in the cave, passion good and blue, Dido with Aeneas, death in a room. The duty calls, our prince got his ring, and Dido left alone, all in the sling, so her love and his will, never meant to be. Dido wants my queen, that the death of love and redeem, so her love, because of the god's mischief, her love and his fate, never ever meant to be. How bittersweet love could ever be.
Well, maybe we'll just go to lunch. Right? No, I'm not giving up yet. I'm not giving up yet. All right, thank you. Thank you, Asosa. That was magnificent. All right, now in a slightly different way, we'll take all that on again. So, right at the top of the handout are the big questions that I want us to have in mind all the way through our exploration of this book now. Beginning with how we want to refer to the book. And if you went through all the scholarly literature, you would find about an equal division between literary critics referring to the book as the book of Aeneas and Dido, or the book of Dido and Aeneas. Who is Virgil's central character here? By the end of the book, what character do we want to say has been most highlighted, most foregrounded? Which character is at the center of Virgil's emotional poetic intensity in this book? And even if we can't give a clear answer to that question, the very fact that in our national Roman epic poem that we surely are being compelled by Virgil in this book to ask that kind of question of centrality is in itself amazing. Amazing. And just think for a moment, and I'll just be hammering at this again and again, just think for a moment of who Dido is. Dido is the queen of infant Carthage. Carthage is the single city, the single nation on the face of the earth for us Romans in the age of Augustus, the single city which in our history has come closest by a huge amount to destroying us. And Hannibal is the single greatest, most destructive and exterminating enemy whom we have ever had. So what is conceivably our great Virgil's poetic purpose in constructing a relationship between our founding national hero, Aeneas, and a queen, the founding queen of Carthage? What could possibly be Virgil's poetic purpose in setting up a relationship in which we are compelled to ask, who is Virgil's central exploration? Just in and of itself, that is an almost unspeakable.
The preceding program was brought to you by Stanford on iTunes U and is copyrighted by the Board of Trustees of the Leland Stanford Junior University. Please visit us at itunes.stanford.edu.